Welcome to an episode of the award-winning podcast Art Insiders New York. My name is Anders Holst. The theme of the podcast is New York, with a focus on behind-the-scenes conversations with fascinating people who are making an impact in the world of art, design, and architecture. J.B. Miller is the visionary leader and CEO of Empire Entertainment. He is a legend in the events industry for creating completely immersive experiences on a global scale. In this interview, J.B. Miller talks about what signifies the experiential events industry, a merger between the events and meeting industry and the entertainment industry that opens wide opportunities for a producer to create cutting-edge events for clients, fulfilling thoughtful, creative, and strategic goals. What are the key resources necessary to create events that will attract people's attention, change the mindset and behavior of key audiences, help launch new products, create new markets, or move the needle of an objective in a major way? He tells us about various projects where the producer is likened to an alchemist at work. The producer, or perhaps rather the experiencer, is a person who is genre agnostic and can move swiftly between various types of gatherings, clients, and locales. One project in particular illustrates how producing a multi-million dollar project in front of a global audience can become a scary high-wire act. J.B. Miller was recognized as Producer of the Year by BizBash's Reader's Choice Award and has been regularly identified as the top people in the U.S. event industry. In 2023, Miller was awarded the Collaborate America Award for outstanding achievement as a collaborator, convener, and connector. Welcome to the podcast, J.B.
Thank you, Anders.
I always wonder, what does JB stand for?
It's J period Bradford Miller. My first name is just the letter, no name. That's always fun when I'm going over an international border, or there's a lot of Millers and some of them have done bad things, even the ones with the letter J as a first name. And sometimes, you know, you go through security and they'll look at you and you'll be like, is that the person that has an outstanding warrant for their arrest? No.
Have you ever discussed this with your parents, why they just settled for a letter rather than a full name?
No, I'm just grateful to be here.
Yeah, aren't we all? And you have a very exciting life, and we're going to talk about that. Now, you create, produce, and oversee production of thousands of major corporate, nonprofit, and private events for major corporations and social and government organizations like United Nations, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and so on and so forth. Before we start, though, full disclosure, you and I are friends.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. And we met some 24 years ago at a wedding in Florence.
May of 2000, and it was your wedding. It was one of the most extraordinary weddings I've ever been a part of, to be certain.
Me too. I felt like I was on a movie set. And since then, we've been great friends, and you helped me one summer when you came up with a brilliant idea of Love Bloom's tour to travel botanical gardens and introduce our smooth jazz to communities around New York. And I got a first glimpse into what it's like working with JB. I can tell you, it was like three-dimensional chess planning. It was so fast, and we actually had a pretty good tour. We had
absolutely. Well, you know, you are a brand, and your music is you know, something that should be brought to the world. So it was kind of fun to kind of create a way for people to understand and wrap their heads around you. It's so hard to differentiate musical artists, right? It's not just genre or the individual, especially when you're trying to break an artist. So the same, you know, tasks that go into trying to differentiate a product or service also come into play when we're trying to, you know, create an identity for a new artist.
That's right. Apart from the immense focus, there was a conceptualization that I was very impressed with. You know, every pieces of the puzzle, they fell into place. And then I actually went to your wedding at the New York Public Library, which was even, you know, topping the thing in the little event in Florence there. That was incredible. I guess our listeners are thinking, so what does Empire Entertainment do? How do you explain that to the man on the street?
In two ways. I mean, at the surface, we are basically a global creative and production event agency. We serve clients, as you mentioned, corporations, not-for-profits, governments, individuals, and we help them develop and execute their creative projects, most frequently live large events, but often broadcasts or live streams or other types of, you know, convenings and gatherings. And we have been doing this for over 30 years, pretty much around the world. You know, I think when I was early in my career at MTV, and we began to see how corporations were, you know, needing to produce something, needing to do some kind of an entertainment product or put on a concert or hire a comedian or create a funny or engaging piece of video. It was clear that corporations, and let's call them institutions, increasingly needed a producer, somebody that could work with them, ideate and conceptualize a production that was made for purpose and objective, and then to actually execute it. And while there are, you know, many great communications people and corporations and strategists, and there are many great entertainment producers working in film and television, concerts and elsewhere, there weren't that many producers who were really dedicated to the task of providing those services and an integrated end-to-end solution to those corporations and institutions. And since starting the company, the demand for that has grown explosively worldwide. And I'd say it's fair that any large-scale institution, any corporation, anyone trying to get influence or attract attention or move the needle on an objective needs a producer of some kind to execute and orchestrate and deliver the creative project that makes that happen.
You would think that like Pepsi or Coca-Cola, they could have these people en masse in their own organization, but there is a unique competence here to coordinate all these things. So part of your what you do is seems to me like very hands-on. It's like logistics. It's like taking care of a number of items on a to-do list. And then you have to take care of an artist or a couple of artists, right? Which requires its own skill. And then part of it is magic.
Yes.
So how do you combine that?
I mean, I don't want to make this, you know, about myself uniquely, but like, let's look at our organization. We have account executives, right? And people that strive to understand the strategy of what our clients are trying to do. We have producers who are engineers and quarterback and manage timelines and production schedules and assets and resources and so on. But we also have creative directors, right? We have writers, we have film, you know, content creators and so on. So you have both creative individuals and engineering, you know, oriented individuals, the left and right brain, if you will, together represented in the organization. And on every project, those individuals come together and collaborate, right? Because you can be the most creative person in the world, but if you don't have a handle on the details and haven't gotten your permits or have the right amount of power, it's not going to happen, and vice versa, yeah. Right? You can have all the production infrastructure and logistical acumen in the world, but if it's not creative and thoughtful and inspiring and pulls the triggers on human emotion, you're not going to achieve your outcome either. So, you know, just in the way that we've both created teams and process to support a both left brain and right brain, a divergent and convergent thinking, you know, aspects of a project, you know, I think that embodies my own personality. You know, my father was military engineer, my mother was an artist, you know, painted behind me. And I think I synthesize both of those sides of the brain reasonably well. And my organization and the people that work at Empire are really a reflection of that multidisciplinary approach.
So you have a creative artist and an engineer cohabitating in your head, which is very unique, I guess. And we'll talk about your management style a little bit later. But let me just add then another thing. So you have the hands-on logistic, like it's a military operation, basically what you're saying. Then you have the creative part of it. But, you know, you have to have the choreography, and then you have to meet some objectives of the client,
yes,
right?
Very much so.
Move the needle you talk about all the time.
Yes.
So you're juggling all these balls in the air, and it all is coming down to your ability then.
Well, not just mine. I mean, I think I represent a larger organization, but I have been at this for a sufficient number of decades that I've put a lot of thought into how best to do that. Right? How best to assess a client's objectives, even if they are not entirely clear on them, how to articulate them, how to identify how we would measure success. What are the KPIs, you know, and ROI? You know, what are the measures of success that we would use and apply? We go through a process of really trying to understand all of those mechanisms and operators before we turn the attention to, should the room be blue or yellow? Should the music be rock or country? Should the catering be, you know, Asian fusion or, you know, or Western? I think it's very important to understand the underpinnings of what you're trying to achieve before you then turn to the how you want to achieve it. In reality, they do emerge concurrently and in a sort of messy, you know, percolating sense. But, you know, just like there are rules to brainstorming, we have developed and synthesized a process, an algorithm for bringing creative and strategy and execution together and putting it into a deliverable package that a client can understand and that can, the results can be quantified.
Here I'm fascinated with the design aspect of these experiences that you provide for your clients. So what is this algorithm that you go through?
Because most clients don't really like to divulge all of the detail, what I'll probably do is anecdotally use a variety of different examples, you know, to show the different stages and phases. Productions are so different. Sometimes it's a concert, sometimes it's a conference, sometimes it's an experiential activation. It's really a little bit schizophrenic. We actually call ourselves genre agnostic producers because I might be called upon to produce a festival, I might be called upon to produce a wedding, and I might be called upon to produce a, you know, something at the United Nations. But what we realized is that there is commonality, right, to all projects. There is a sequence of understanding the project and assessing its needs and resources, understanding and clarifying those objectives, thinking through what is the creative approach to achieving those executives, and then, of course, planning and executing and delivering the project. So one of the parts of our, you know, equation, we call it our blueprint or our pipeline at Empire, it was to recognize that there are multiple junctures along the road to any project, from first understanding of the project to final debriefing. And we believe that we have to have four archetypical people present at every one of those junctures. An account executive or an advocate, right, for the client who understands what the client's trying to do and keep that voice, you know, an objective front and center. Certainly a creative director who would think creatively about how to accomplish things. A producer who is really the quarterback, you know, of the project, really managing and orchestrating the various resources and budgets and timelines and to-do lists and task lists, as you say. And then very often, you know, a technical director, because much of what we do is at a level that requires a technical understanding, you know, multi-camera international broadcasts, for example, or, you know, producing a big concert in a union venue with multiple artists coming on and off stage and all of that. And what we found is that when we bring those core four people together, right from the first assessment of an opportunity, then through to the development of a proposal, a solution, and expressing that, you know, to a client, overcoming their objectives and refining that planning, moving into the production, a kickoff of the production, you know, making sure that everybody is aligned about what it is that we're trying to produce, through the actual execution of it, right? We can't produce one thing if creative is going rogue over here and, you know, the producer is going rogue over here. We have to create some synchronization of those individuals' efforts, and everybody needs to know what moving they're making,
yeah,
right? So that we are all making the same movie. And that's a discipline. And then, you know, moving into sort of like final production and bringing all the stakeholders and clients and caterers into the, you know, the event is important. And then obviously debriefing, understanding, you know, did it go right or wrong? So the first part of my answer is that, you know, we've built this blueprint that very much relies on having those four archetypical perspectives from the beginning of the project to the very conclusion. That helps us align, you know, and understand those. But I think your question was also about, like, how do we assess objectives and how do we think through, you know, what would be the best ways to achieve them and measure them and to ultimately implement them. And that's, you know, something that, again, I've been working on my entire career. But I think to succinctly put it, you know, the first is having a really rigorous approach to the objectives. Many clients will call us and say, you know, we're doing our annual conference next year, or we're, you know, launching this product, or we're, you know, trying to get more advertisers to spend more money with us earlier in the year than they traditionally have. And we have to just get very rigorous at that point and say, like, well, what does that mean? Like, how would you quantify that? What are those, in fact, your objectives? Are you of the same mind as your marketing team, as your product team, and so on? So really first just drilling down and understanding what the event is designed to do and making sure that we and our clients are fully aligned, you know, around that. From that point, you know, when we understand the objectives, and here's where we often rely on our clients because these are collaborations, we have to understand what are the behavioral mechanisms and the logical operators that actually make people do the thing that you want them to do, that influence the behavior. Because I know how to entertain somebody, but I don't necessarily know how to take industrial buyer, who's very committed to a very long-standing relationship with a pre-existing industrial buyer that's not my client, and get them to revisit and reconsider that maybe they've been doing it wrong all these years and that it's time to jump ship and move on to something else. And that's not just selling or understanding the product. That's understanding the psychology of why somebody with an entrenched behavior relinquishes that the firmness and then opens their mind and is susceptible to influence or new or better messaging such that they change the behavior and move it. And I'm not a psychiatrist. I can't pretend to understand those things. But together in discussion with our clients who should know these things, we consult together and we try to say, well, creating goodwill would be important. Allowing our executive leadership's personality to come through and create close affinity, demonstrating to somebody that bigger clients than them have made the same decision previously and the water is safe to make this decision. You won't lose your job for making a decision. I'm just giving some rough examples, but these are some of the sort of behavioral operators. Mm-hmm. And then we jump back in and say, okay, if we're trying to establish that personal touch, mm-hmm. right, that relationship for the new CEO versus the old CEO who they know and like so much and golf with, maybe it's about engineering an event where they are really spending a lot of time together. Maybe we, you know, turn off the chairlift when they're, you know, up skiing together and have that hour of, you know, discovery of relationship with each other in a forced setting. I don't, but, you know, like, you know, understanding then how the mechanisms that are available to us within different events or event formats can come into play and be leveraged in order to achieve those.
I see.
And then from that point forwards, you know, once we have a good creative overlay, actually executing that and making sure that those individuals spend that face time, that those points are made in the right ways. And, you know, I joke sometimes that we are producers of experiential propaganda, but the truth is much of what we do is about influencing behavior. That's why we're so uniquely suited for this job, because I think we understand the rational, logical side of the equation, but also on an emotional side.
I think it's so interesting. I read about the articles about you, this merger between the meeting and event industry and the entertainment industry with all the various resources at your disposal. So is there then a moment in the process where you get your team together and say, okay, what are we going to do here? Are we going to do a video? Are we going to bring in an artist? You have all these tools in the toolbox.
Yes.
Is that the most fun part of the project?
Actually, it's all fun. It's all fun and it's all painful, but then it's all fun again. I think it's, you know, it's a fallacy to think that happens at any one juncture. I mean, the truth is we do, once we understand the objectives and you know, the ROI and the behavioral mechanisms, then there is a creative process where we say, well, what kinds of things within an event, what elements within the event could be used to achieve that? You know, so for example, if I'm trying to, facilitate a business-to-business connectivity, right? Would I use a keynote, you know, or a presentation to communicate, you know, product attributes, right? Would I use workshops to let people get a hands-on experience with the thing? So there are tools within events and mechanisms within events that we can use and deploy that are better for accomplishing certain kinds of outcomes and so on. It's also ongoing. Like, there's not like one point where we say, okay, it's going to be a this or a that. Sometimes we sit down and we say, you know, what would be a really great way to keep the brand front and center during the dinner would be some kind of centerpiece or table where you turn over the plate and there's some unique messaging just to you with the brand in it. That's a takeaway item. Those are ideas that will come up in the natural course of things that are not necessarily everything is grounded in.
Yeah.
Last year, when we celebrated our 30th anniversary, we did a lot of soul searching at an organization, ours, to determine, you know, what do we mean? Why are we here? Why do we work so hard to do these things? And where we arrived very naturally at the end of the sort of the soul searching process was that, you know, we at Empire produce moments that matter. We are certainly engineers of moments, right? Of instance where, you know, the music is great, the goodwill is flowing, the visual is extraordinary, the surprise, the wow factor is all in the room, the chemistry of putting people together with food and alcohol and setting and visuals and a narrative all can come into play. But we also believe in producing moments that matter, right? Like translating that experience into an outcome or something that changes. And I think it so beautifully encapsulates what we believe in and what we do and what we're passionate about, mm-hmm. which is engineering those moments that matter. Mm. And we've been really fortunate to play, I think, really instrumental roles in some of the great issues of our time, introducing new technologies, driving, you know, to, you know, newer renewable forms of energy, helping promote sustainability, helping fight the pandemic, you know, all of these are things that you wouldn't necessarily think producers have a hand in, but we really do. And it's a privilege to do it.
Exactly. And I think one of the wonderful things is that you are sort of on the cutting edge, on the forefront of bringing new things into this conversations, into this experience. But you're also initiating where the trend is going by introducing things. So it's a two-way street here.
That's very, very true.
And I find it very interesting also the range here, because if you do a science seminar, you really have to know something about the substance.
Something about the substance. I mean, yeah. I never pretend to be a scientist, but yes, certainly understanding, you know, the forums in which scientists need to gather, how they exchange best practices and information, what's important to them, are critical components to our job. I do sometimes look at the poster sessions and the things, and I'm like, I wish I understood what I'm looking at, but I simply don't. I never will. But that's why there's different kinds of expertise.
Exactly. And you seem to me to be a Renaissance person who can travel very easily, you know, around the various areas of knowledge and insights. Now, in our previous conversation, you mentioned that there is somewhat of a shift here, like the eyeball philosophy of the communication world is maybe not working any longer. Can you expand on that, why that is, and what the alternative would be, and how can you do the alternative on a large scale?
I didn't invent this concept, but I think we all acknowledge that advertising in its traditional forms, right? There are just more channels. There's more content. There's more places to see advertising. It's more ubiquitous. It follows you into the elevator. You know, it follows you, you know, everywhere. And, you know, with more messaging and more clutter, you know, around you, I think as humans, we have evolved to tune a lot of it out. The efficacy of that advertising. I mean, once upon a time, if you were, you know, on a 3-hour drive and you drove past one billboard or two billboards, chances are you would recall that billboard. Now on a 3-hour drive, you're probably getting exposed to 150, 200 messages. Good luck remembering some of those. And that's just, you know, one example. It's the same is true of television advertising. There's also a splintering, a fractioning, right? There's just more cable channels. There's more digital places. There's just more content everywhere, and TikTok and social and everything. It's just, there's, with so much of it in your face, it's just like a blizzard of impressions. And it becomes much harder for an individual to process any one impression as very influential, you know, in their own behaviors. Simultaneously, what we do, bringing people into a discrete point of time and place where we have absolute control over all of their senses, the smells, right, the sights, the sounds, the experience, the touch, the narrative, the ability to, you know, first this happens, then you look up, then you hear this, then your heartstrings are plucked by this emotional moment, much deeper, you know, forms of engagement. And when we combine it with other people and you know, amplification and all the other tricks of our trade,
yeah.
I would argue that a minute of experience or an impression of in-person experience is vastly more valuable in terms of impact and influence than an impression of, say, a billboard or a digital ad, you know, on your phone. And I only say, you know, nothing against the advertising media, you know, supported industry, but what I do believe is that brands and marketers and institutions are recognizing that if we want to influence people, experiential is a great way to do it. There's more ROI by getting somebody in the room than, you know, showing them an ad, you know, that they drive by something. So I think just strictly by comparison of those two ROIs, I think a lot of people are waking up to the fact that experiential and events are a better way to engage people dollar for dollar than, say, traditional forms of media. And I think that positions us and Empire in a really unique place because we understand it, we're experienced, we've, you know, done this for every kind of industry and sector and purpose, and really care about the outcomes for our clients and have been delivering it. So I think that there is likely going to be an increasing push to put more dollars into experiential and events, not just for marketing, but also just for influence and behavioral change. And that bodes very well for the experiential and the events industry, especially a global one and a creative one that can cut across, you know, different kinds of industries and sectors.
Yeah. Have you thought about it, then, the ability to somehow do that experiential experience on a larger scale? For instance, like if let's say you have a big event and then you have to have a follow-up with a patient, so they keep, I mean, how do you, can you do that? Can you recreate that online? Or
absolutely. I mean, I think like we have some traditional tools of scaling, right? I mean, like the event that we did for 500 people in a room, next year let's do it for 5,000 in an arena, right? Or the event that worked so well for 500 people in New York, why don't we do that in Chicago, Dallas, LA, DC, Amsterdam, Paris, and Singapore, you know, as well. The event that we did, let's live stream it to a wider audience, the people that can't necessarily come, let's make sure that we're live streaming it. Or if we can put the right amount of celebrity and attention to it, why don't we broadcast it? Why don't we create a content series out of it? You know, social media and digital media have given us the ability to create an advanced constellation of content around an event, you know, before, during the event. I'm live tweeting from here, this live remote, you know, on this news channel from this event. And then in the aftermath, did you see what happened? So, you know, being able to use the event and the experience and to scale and amplify that, both through time in the before, during, and after, and in terms of reaching far more audience, you know, overall. You know, like years ago, I worked on an event, you may remember it, but it was for Harper's Bazaar. It was an event called Icons. It was at the Plaza Hotel. And I think Nicki Minaj and Cardi B, don't quote me on this, like got into a fist fight, you know, at the event.
Okay.
There were only, you know, several hundred people at the event, but the entire world knew about that event, right? We worked on the Time 100, and I think, you know, Kim Kardashian was on the red carpet, you know, bulbs flashing and the world paying attention to her. And Amy Schumer, who was a guest that year, accidentally tripped and fell in front of her, right? Thus capturing all of the attention. Probably 2 billion people that know that it happened.
Yeah.
So the ability for even events to scale and reach everybody's consciousness is extraordinarily powerful. And I think that's a lot of, you know, what we do is to strategize, well, how would we make sure a closed door event for a finite set of attendees can reach all kind, you know, unlimited numbers of individuals and cohorts. When my career in this business was just, you know, starting out, the idea that a brand would license a Led Zeppelin song, you know, to sell Cadillacs, it was completely like, you would have been looked at as crazy, because there was like rock and roll, which was like nothing that any brand or self-respecting brand wanted to get involved with.
Yeah.
You know, and now everybody recognizes that, like, you know, celebrities and, you know, popular culture that attract people, that's where the eyeballs are. That's what people are paying attention to. So why wouldn't you, you know, short of brand risk, associate yourself with that, or better still, host that, be, you know, central to that, of bringing that to people. So I think the negativity around that has dropped off, and, you know, not to equate it with, you know, the current, you know, movement and legislation around cannabis, you know, in the United States. But like once upon a time, like, you know, you got arrested and went to prison, you know, if you were like smoking weed. Now the federal government is like really looking at, like, is this really something that we really need to be concerned with? Perhaps not. So there are evolutions of perception over time that do open up new forms of opportunity. And, you know, in our world, I think it's about, you know, we all listened to that music back then.
Yeah.
But why didn't our brands, like, you know, feel it was safe to associate with it? Now I think brands are just much more comfortable to associate with popular culture, And popular culture is more comfortable associating with brands that they believe in.
So you hang out with major celebrities around the world, artists and so on. Do you ever get starstruck?
No, I can't say that I ever have. I think one of the occupational hazards of what I do is that when I'm working with a celebrity, it doesn't matter who it is, Taylor Swift, you know, I'm ultimately the producer. My job is to deliver a successful experience that incorporates and involves that celebrity. So we are collaborating. We are working together to achieve a shared outcome. And we're professionals and working hard to make sure it happens. So I kind of, you know, approach it not as like, oh my God, I'm such a big fan of yours, I can't even speak. I have to kind of walk in and be like, here's what we're doing and make sure that they're aligned and that we're all working together. So I don't have the luxury of being starstruck anymore, unfortunately.
I guess people who are listening to this are thinking, okay, so what was the toughest project he's ever worked on? And I remember you told me once, and I'm not going to mention any names here, but there was a wedding on three Caribbean islands. That to me seems like a pretty complicated and challenging project. But is there anything you care to mention in terms of a hairy project that was really challenging you to the?
Sure, I that particular wedding for a very well-known corporate figure was amazing. We brought down all kinds of talent and built venues and produced things on islands that, you know, had not even electricity or water, let alone, you know, the ability to support, you know, giant stages and everything else. But I think I may have mentioned this before. I was fortunate enough to work on the grand opening of Atlantis Palm Island in Dubai many years ago. And in addition to being sort of the talent producer and working on sort of like the stage program with Kylie Minogue and, you know, Priyanka Chopra and all kinds of other things, I was also calling the show, basically stage managing, wearing the headset and talking to lighting and sound and fireworks and video and, you know, everybody else to orchestrate the action and the movement, you know, because, you know, in it's like directing, it's like being a director, but, you know, in live, you're calling all the action. Mm-hmm. And in this particular moment, I was sitting up in this scaffold tower looking out over, you know, 2,000 plus people, you know, almost half the royal families of the Middle East. And we were in the middle of a building projection, like 600 feet wide, or, you know, the biggest building projection that had ever been attempted, that was leading into the biggest fireworks show in human history, which was coming right out of a Kylie Minogue performance, you know, on the last song and these announcements. And all of this technology tends to be synchronized by something called time code, right? The same thing that you use for video editing. It just basically is a reference tone of time code that makes, you know, fireworks talk to audio, talk to lighting, talk to all the, you know, computer systems that run this stuff. And as we were just a couple minutes away from the start of the fireworks and the performance, I get this, I call out to everybody, and there were probably 100, 200 people on comms. We were calling in multiple languages, you know, because there were people from the Middle East, there were German engineers, there were all kinds of people. And I just called out, I was just like, okay, just... as we're heading into this final stretch, just making sure that everybody is seeing time code, right? Just a pre-event check to make sure that like everything is synchronized. And all of a sudden I start hearing back from the departments, I'm not seeing it, I don't see it. And you have to understand the fireworks, every one of the 2,400 firing positions are synchronized to the music, to all of this stuff. So the fact that like no one was seeing it and the time code wasn't there, and everybody concurred, we don't see it, we can't synchronize this, This is landing. And in that moment, I said, how long will it take to reboot the computer, sending the time code to see if we can sync it up? And they were like, 3 minutes. And I was like, stage manager, how much more time is left in this song? They were like, 3 minutes and 30 seconds. I'm like, go, reboot it now. So they shut the computer down. We're all listening. They're like, okay, it's starting. It's rebooting. You know, we're 2 minutes and 30 seconds. We're getting to the end of the song. This is about to, like, there's no way to stop this train. For 3 minutes, like, is anyone seeing it? Nope, nothing. 3 minutes, 5 seconds. Anyone seeing it? Nothing. 3 minutes, 10 seconds. Nothing. We were like maybe 10 seconds before the start of this whole sequence. And then I hear, you know, saying like, oh, I'm seeing it, and the video sees it, and I'm like, okay, great, stand by, here we go, 5, 4, and we like went right into it. But like those moments of like everything riding. I mean, the world was where helicopters are circling. We're broadcasting this live on like BBC around the world to everybody. Like those are the stressful moments where you just have to like remain calm, yeah. Fly the plane, be the center of the thing.
Oh my God, what a story. On a more personal note, I read in an interview with you talking about your management style that curiosity is really important for growth.
I'm fortunate in that I am a naturally curious person. I do like to learn new things. I get bored, you know, sort of easily. So I need to constantly challenge myself by, you know, learning and exposing myself to different things. It's part of why this career is ideally suited to me, because I can jump from sports to technology, from global health to, you know, popular culture. And I very often find myself in a room where I have the least expertise, the least knowledge of things, and yet I'm being looked to provide ultimately the most guidance of the entire effort and enterprise. So to learn to be a quick study and to understand what is necessary. I'll never be a scientist or, you know, an engineer, but I can understand enough about what I need to know to effectively do my job. You know, keeps me sharp, keeps me on my toes. And I think that the people that work with me have a similar appetite for that kind of learning and challenge, you know, nonstop. I mean, there are many fickle roles and responsibilities and careers, but, you know, being a large live event producer where you get a one-shot deal to get it right, where you are expected to come in and not just do something for the automotive industry, but lead the way the automotive industry is engaging with consumers or, you know, moving, making a transition to e-vehicles or whatever. That's a huge area of responsibility. And I just find it very both challenging, but also invigorating to be in that position, to always be a little bit afraid, right? And always feel like you're playing catch up with what you need to know.
Yeah.
So I find that rewarding.
And that, of course, translates through the whole organization then, that this is how we live and breathe, because you said somewhere that you like history and science and other areas. You go often outside of your business zone because someday you have to present this to someone else, right? So,
yeah.
So you have to sort of internalize these things. And then you mentioned karma. I thought that was interesting.
At the end of it, we're all just people, right? And our lives are finite, if that's what you believe. And the greatest moments of our lives are those where we get to come together, right? For a variety of purposes, whether just to celebrate or to exchange best practices or to influence each other and so on. Those moments, you know, really do require a certain amount of goodwill, checking your ego at the door, being willing and open to try new experiences, being willing to listen to a new musical artist or hear what a speaker on stage, you know, has to say, or to try an exercise that we ask an audience to engage in, you know, or to turn to the person to your right and introduce yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And I think part of what we have to do professionally, but also what we believe in, is, you know, how do we create a conducive environment for people to open themselves up to experience, to be kind and compassionate with each other, to be giving, you know, of each other and willing to receive what others, you know, can give. And I think that's one of the great gifts of being in this industry is to be playing a key role in facilitating so much exchange between people, so much positive exchange. Conflict resolution. So in that sense, I think, you know, we engineer karma is one of those, you know, outcomes, one of those things that matter, you know, that come out of the events. I think the other one is just more obvious, and this is not unique to the events industry at all. It's true in all industries, but the world is small, you know, life is short, and, you know, people, you need to be good to each other, right? If you have a bad reputation, if you stiff a contractor like some, you know, former presidents, you know, you're going to get a bad reputation.
Yeah.
If you are mean, you know, and rude to people, guess what? Creative people are going to shut down. They're not going to give you their best ideas, right? Artists, you know, that are, you know, yelled at and said, you need to be on stage, they're not going to show up and give their very best performance. So I think, you know, part of it is also teasing, you know, great behaviors and the best out of people. And that's just being a good professional, being a friendly person, you know, walking up to a CEO who might seem really nervous and angry, you know, the moment they get out on stage, and just recognizing, hey, public speaking is the number one fear. So maybe what can I do to set that person at ease and let them go out and do a better job at their thing? That's karma.
Yeah, that's very well put. I love that. I think many people are very curious about AI. So now you have something new in the toolbox here.
I think in many ways, I mean, certainly tools like Midjourney, you know, or DALL-E and others are great design partners, right? They're design co-pilots. You know, I might think, what's an all white and gold stage going to look like in this kind of an environment? And I might, you know, as a designer, come up with one or two ideas. But, you know, you plug something like that into DALL-E and Midjourney, they'll suggest some other ideas that just maybe never would have occurred to you because it's, you know, crowdsourced from the hive mind of, you know, all previous imagery, you know, that's been ingested into the learning model. So I do find that, you know, from a design standpoint, AI is offering up alternate suggestions. It's a great brainstorming partner, if you will. I like John Mayer. Tell me some other artists like John Mayer because he's not available on this event. That's just predictive analytics. That's, I mean, you know, Spotify does that, you know,
yeah.
Amazon does that when you go and purchase an album. You might also like this. That's just, you know, establishing a higher probabilistic relationship between one artist and another. Or if you like this, you're probably going to like this, and amassing enough statistical knowledge around that. I think those are insights certainly that make our job easier when we're trying to find an act. but, you know, it's a brainstorm partner. If I say I want to do a, you know, pirate themed party, you know, ChatGPT will spit out like 150, you know, great ideas. And we may say, done that, not, that's not right here. But, you know, along the way, some of those ideas may be new, or invite you more specially to trigger yourself to come up with a third idea that actually makes it all right.
Yeah.
So that's why I call AI, at least at this stage, a brainstorm partner, as opposed to something that's doing our job for us. It's not. But, you know, I can see so many ways for AI to be implemented in events, and we're experimenting with lots of these now. Just, you know, can AI use facial recognition to customize an event, right? If you walk into a room and your favorite color is blue and your favorite music is jazz, you know, can you walk into a room and can AI use facial recognition to recognize that it's Anders coming in the room and adjust the environment in real time to create something more conducive to you? Sure. Those are easy parlor tricks. I think where it's going to get really interesting is in the years ahead when we get very sophisticated about applying these tools.
I see. So you had your 30th anniversary now. How far ahead do you look into the future?
We started as, you know, two individuals in one office in Soho. Today we're, you know, 85 plus and growing around the world with, you know, New York and Tokyo headquarters and people, you know, located in cities around the world. I think we're growing the size and scale and influence of the events that we're doing. You know, sometimes we were, you know, doing small sort of like private, you know, sales meetings for clients you hadn't heard of. Now we're working for the biggest brands in the world on their biggest tentpole events that are getting the biggest, you know, attention. I think as institutions are recognizing the value and the efficacy of events to achieve their big outcomes, I think there's a great moment for us to be to step into a wider role in changing and shaping the world. Our work with the United Nations now is really exciting. I mean, I feel like myself and my team are actually playing an active role in supporting advancement and progress on the Sustainable Development Goals, which is a great thing to say if you're, you know, coming from an entertainment, you know, producing background.
Yeah.
But I, you know, we're expanding into broadcast. More of our events are broadcast and live stream and content creation. So I can see us, you know, bringing out television programming, you know, in the years ahead. We're starting to own and develop our own IP, our own events and event platforms, for which we'll, you know, rent marketing utility to our clients, but we will own and operate and scale them. We are looking to do geographic expansion, most notably, Europe, Middle East, and Africa division. Even though we've worked there for since the beginning, so that's sort of like some of the things on our dev stack or our dev roadmap as we look at the years ahead.
What are you working on right now?
Lots of different things. Everything from a series of ultra high level thought leadership insight summits sort of finance sector, where we're looking at, you know, the future of political risk, geopolitical risk, future of AI, the impact of new technologies, of longevity and other kinds of, you know, inputs to help them see around corners and see into the far distant future and make appropriate investment decisions. I'm working with one of the major sovereign wealth funds to basically, create events where their partnership with global other co-investors and so on can be organized around a thesis of, like, you know, what is their, you know, investment theme around infrastructure and how would they inform themselves to do that. I am working on with the UN right now on the Sustainable Development Goals and creating events that help influence policymakers and bring, you know, powerful influencers and stakeholders and heads of NGOs together, especially as we now move into the second half of the SDG, you know, window of time. There's time pressure, right? Can we get these done or not? So how do we inspire enough global action now to actually move the needle, you know, on achieving these goals or some of them? But we also are doing some parties, you know, we're doing some cool backyard concerts and launching, you know, new shows for Bravo and, you know, all kinds of fun things. One thing I would say is that traditionally people in our industry have been thought of, you know, as a service industry, as meeting producers, event planners, event designers, and so on. And I do think that experiential or events is truly coming into its own. You know, there are, you know, when you think about motion picture and you think about, you know, Christopher Nolan, Stanley Kubrick, you know, the great directors of films, you know, or television for that matter, or music, you know, for that matter, it's easy to sort of pinpoint a creative and say that's, you know, the person that sits at the top of that pyramid, you know. And but when people look at our industry, I don't think that they recognize that, you know, for every David Rockwell in the design world, there's a J.B. Miller, you know, that sort of is, you know, I feel like we are the Spielbergs of experience in many ways. And I hope that the world will continue to wake up to, especially as important as experience is and experiential is, that there are, you know, extraordinary individuals, you know, out there, which I hope to include myself as one, who are engineering experience that change our world and the quality of our life, you know, in this time.
Well, this is wonderful. Really, I love this topic. I've had so much fun going through all these articles. I really had a great time, and thank you for.
And Andres, thank you for your, you know, curiosity. I think, you know, you are unique in your understanding of the business context, you know, from a consulting and business background. But I think you also have a true appreciation of the creative. And I think in that regard, you and I really do share, you know, a lot of that left brain, right brain instinct. So it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. And thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you, JB. This has been a fascinating conversation. And again, congratulations to a wonderful job that you're doing all over the world and for all the great stuff that you are producing.
Thank you very much, Anders. Appreciate it.
This is Art Insiders New York, and my name is Anders Holst. If you enjoyed this episode and have family and friends who love New York and are passionate about the world of art, design, and architecture in the city, please spread the word by following us on artinsidersnewyork.com or liking us on our Facebook page, Art Insiders New York, where we publish newsworthy material all the time. It's very much appreciated. Thank you. This episode was produced by UOM LLC, copyright 2024.